What does it mean to be a mindful parent?
Parenting is natural. No, it's biological. But to parent the child you have in front of you takes a process of growth, takes a process of enlightenment, takes a process of increased consciousness to now meet the needs of this spirit who you've never met before and learn to match and guide this spirit as they need to be guided.
Clinical psychologist Shefali Sabari answers your questions and offers advice about how to take a more spiritual approach to your parenting. Later, the Illinois Department of Public Health yesterday confirmed the first human case of West Nile virus so far in the state this year, months earlier than last year. We'll talk to Director Nirav Shah about how to protect yourself from the mosquito-borne illness this summer. Plus, a new free app to help make your flights more interesting. It's called Flyover Country. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're a parent, you probably already know that having a child can be one of the most satisfying and rewarding experiences of your life. And you also know how hard it can be at times. Although becoming a parent is linked to our biology, being a good parent is anything but a natural phenomenon. Those are the words of Shefali Sabari, a clinical psychologist and author of the new book, The Awakened Family. Sabari takes many commonly held beliefs about parenting and flips them on their head and shares how the challenges of parenting can become an opportunity for spiritual awakening. She'll be in Evanston tonight at 7 o'clock to speak about her book and answer questions. Because she's traveling today, she joined us earlier on the phone from her home in New York. Shefali, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm so happy to be with you.
This book is a follow-up to your award-winning and New York Times bestselling book, The Conscious Parent. And there are many overlapping ideas between the two books. So I wanted to start off and ask if you could explain to folks, what does being a conscious parent mean?
The conscious parent is one who is aware that they're bringing into the interaction and journey with their child their own projections, their own fantasies, their own expectations. And this is often more unquestioned, more unbridled in the parent-child dynamic because parents are not usually asked to look at their own stuff, you know. They're just allowed to do whatever they want with their kids because, after all, they're their kids. They're almost treated like our possessions. And it's this that causes dysfunction and disconnection. And a conscious parent is one who is aware of this and tries to rein these projections back in so that they can attune to the child that is before them and not, raise the child of their fantasy.
Well, and I think go ahead.
And in this way, the child learns to be in touch with who they are versus who their parent wants them to be.
Well, and I think that it's oftentimes when one becomes a parent and starts parenting, some people do sort of naturally, it becomes a natural cycle where you start thinking, my parents did this, or maybe I'm doing that. Do you think that maybe it's just that people don't spend enough time analyzing that or spending time with that?
Yeah, like you said in the introduction, parenting is natural. No, it's biological. But to parent the child you have in front of you takes a process of growth, takes a process of enlightenment, takes a process of increased consciousness to now meet the needs of this spirit who you've never met before and learn to match and guide this spirit as they need to be guided, right? So just because it's biological doesn't mean we know how to do this. And we shouldn't be under the illusion that we know how to do this because then we'll never be humble enough to say, how is my child teaching me? So my whole approach in the Awakened Family is to help the parent understand what in their relationship with their child is all them and to recognize what is truly coming from the child so that now we can meet the needs of the child rather than the needs of our inner child, so to speak.
And that sounds like a long process. How do you think people should get into that?
Well, it's a process that may take time to mature within you because it takes a discipline and insight and wisdom to live in the present moment so that you are attuned to the child in front of you. But really, it can happen in one instant because your child will tell you, no, you know, why are you treating me like that? Why are you not being nice to me? Why are you making me somebody else? I'm not that person. If we pay attention Our children are always teaching us how we need to be with them. Our problem is not that it's a long process. Our problem is that we are in resistance to the present moment and to the lessons that our children are hankering us for us to learn. It's just because we don't want to be present that we, resist the wisdom that our children offer us.
Why do you think we don't want to be present?
Because we're conditioned. I call it the Kool-Aid that all of us have drunk, this mass cultural forgetting to be in our essential selves, to live in the present moment, to be connected to the here and now. We've been conditioned to do, to achieve. We think that happiness comes from being busy and distracted and our accomplishments. And while those things are nice, they certainly don't lead to inner peace and joy. So we've pivoted outside of ourselves. We've just forgotten. We've just trained ourselves and our children the wrong way. And my book is an invitation to look at things in a completely, radically new way so that you can touch inner peace, joy, freedom, and creativity, which is our right.
A lot of your book you describe as sort of this meld of Eastern and Western philosophies. How did you start this journey yourself?
Well, I was being trained as a Western therapist. I was trained here. I came from India, but I was trained here in the West and going through my PhD program in clinical psychology. But on my personal journey was a meditator and a mindfulness practitioner, learning about insight and being silent and what it means to be with yourself and be with, be a witnesser to your thoughts and learning to de-identify with your thoughts, that the thoughts are just conditionings and belief systems, not us. And as I began to touch my true self, I began to help my clients discover their true self. And then I began to teach people about the, it's good to have the psychological foundation of Western psychology. And that married with the insight that Eastern philosophy brings, it's a potent combination to help healing occur.
I'm speaking with Shefali Sabari. She's a clinical psychologist, and she's author of the new book, The Awakened Family. She's speaking at 7 o'clock at Evanston Township High School tonight. She's giving a talk followed by a Q&A and a book signing. And, as you're talking about all of this, I think about there's so many myths that we have in American culture about parenting. And you've taken several chapters in your book to do some of these myth busting of commonly held beliefs about parenting. And one of them is that this notion that good parents are naturals. And you say that you yourself were ill prepared for motherhood and that the only mother I was equipped to be was the mother of my fantasy. How did you overcome that yourself?
Just through deep courage and introspection, when I saw that I was messing up my daughter, I was confused about what boundaries I should give. I didn't know how to set a limit. My inner unmet needs to be liked, to be a pleaser, were trumping what my daughter needed from me, right? She needed me to be clear, to be consistent, to not be afraid of her pushback. But because I had inner unmet needs around being an accommodating, pleasing, I had not finished that inner business and I still was looking for approval, but it was happening unconsciously. When I saw I was messing up my daughter, I looked in that mirror and I said, okay, how are my unmet needs now creating a disconnection between me and my daughter? Because I was getting angry at my daughter for not listening to me, not realizing it was me who was not creating clear boundaries because I had unmet needs. So the minute I could look in the mirror, then I began the process of deconstruction and, reconstruction and creating a new way of dealing with my child. And that's what I talk about in The Awakened Family. Don't be instinctual about your parenting because that's unconscious. That's default parenting of what your parents did or the opposite of what your parents did. Don't do that. Use every moment with your child as an invitation to reconstruct your awareness in the present moment. And in this way, our children show us not only what we need to heal, they actually force us to go back and say, okay, I got to look at my stuff. This is about me. It's nothing to do with my child. And then you can return to your child and create that deep connection.
One of our producers saw this meme that was going around Facebook, and it shows a parent frustrated with their child, and it says, "You're making it hard for me to be the parent I always imagined I would be." And so, I mean, to that end, what other advice do you have for people to take? Because it sort of sounds like the first step you're saying is you have to have a realistic view of what your parenting is, as opposed to the idealism that people maybe often start out with.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's the most simple thing in the world, because I do it all the time, is look in the mirror. Every moment in your life is an invitation and a reflection for you to go deeper, to look at yourself. It's a reflection of yourself. It's an invitation to go deeper. So people live obscured from this invitation. They live hidden from this truth that everything that happens to us is an invitation to go deeper, to become truer to yourself. You know, we just pretend like things are happening to us and we are just these, you know, hapless victims of life, and we're constantly reacting to life instead of seeing how we are co-creating life and that we're not victims of life. We are absolutely making it happen, but we don't want to take ownership of that, because that means, you know, the onus of change is on us. So it's so much easier to take your kid to therapy and leave them there and pretend like it's all them, fix the kid, don't look at the parent. And this is toxic. And my book challenges this first premise of parenting, that the child needs to be fixed. No. If at all, first you need to be fixed, if anyone needs to be fixed at all. And I don't want to say fixing to mean that something's broken, but does it mean that we all need to grow? Yes. And us parents far more than our children.
And I think the interesting thing about this is many of us, myself included, I grew up with Indian parents. So the notion was very clear that parents were in charge, that adults are in charge, not just parents, mm-hmm. adults are in charge, and that children should obey. You describe the parent-child relationship as one of equals, and you use the analogy of a dance where one partner leads for a bit while the other follows. And I can imagine you get pushback, particularly I'm thinking from your Indian relatives, about people who believe that parents should always be in charge.
You know, when I point that Indian parent or that parent who was raised in a controlled hierarchical environment back to their own child self, back to their own childhood, and I ask them, did that really work for you? Because the first defense is like, I was beaten up and look at me, I'm so amazing. And I ask them, was it really working for you in that moment? If you can have the courage to tell me, did you love getting beaten up? Did you love getting yelled at? Did you love being scared of your parents? Did you love being constantly terrified of not being approved of? If you can honestly tell me that there was no side effects to that, then we can have an honest conversation.
Oh,
and
sure.
No parent can say that. They all go back and they say, I hated it. I resented my parents. I lived in fear of them. In fact, I'm still shedding off that fear. So my premise is not that the children are equal to us in, you know, say, awareness of safety or awareness of, you know, where the boundary needs to be laid. No, they need us to lay a boundary with them. They need us to create a home that says, no, bedtime is at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock or whatever time it is, depending on the age. You cannot expect a three-year-old to know what bedtime is. The conditions have to be created by us. What I mean by saying that they are our equals is that they have every right to be a child, so that they have every right to not know how to control their emotions. They have every right to be who it is they want to be in life, gay, straight, you know, tattooed, or an artist, or a painter, or an accountant. They have every right to say no to us because they are sovereign beings. We don't have to be threatened by this. We are not totalitarian dictators that need children to be puppets, but yet we unconsciously want that. And if we keep doing that, we will keep a legacy of dependency within our children for life. You know, we think that when our parents are hierarchical, we become independent. No, we become more dependent and cannot get out of enmeshed relationships. I'm saying in the Awakened Family, treat your children with the autonomy to be who it is they need to be in life. Don't give up your job as being the one who institutes boundaries, but boundaries are very different from strict authoritarian control.
Mm-hmm.
Boundaries, boundaries are beautiful. Everyone needs boundaries. They are a big yes to life. Control and authoritarian regime are a big no to spirit.
Well, and it sounds like you're not saying you don't want to raise children who will grow up to respect authority. You're just saying parents also need to respect their children.
Absolutely. Respect that they are not them. They are not going to be little me's. They're not going to be little puppets. They are who it is they want to be in this life. It's our responsibility to take them there and to usher them to that expression of self.
Shefali, we spoke to some of our listeners on Facebook, and we asked them beforehand what questions they had for you to answer. And Faith, one of our listeners, posted on our Facebook page, and she wanted to hear your suggestions on how to get your child to listen to you without being a controlling parent. What are your thoughts on that? Or she also said, what are some ways to motivate my child without using a reward system?
Well, the first one is, how do you get your child to listen to you without without yelling, screaming?
Right, let's do that one first, because we just have about a minute or two before the break, and then we'll pick up the second one after the break. So how do you get your children to listen to you without being controlling or yelling?
Well, I think it's about developing that deep connected relationship and not entering the relationship expecting unilateral obedience. It's understanding that this is a co-created relationship, and to create the cooperation takes where the child buys into whatever the parent is trying to sell them. And I talk about in my book, The Awakened Family, that parents need to embody things that they wish to see in the home themselves, right? So if you want the kid at 2 years old to suddenly start brushing their teeth, you kind of need to sell this as a life-enhancing principle, and you need to embody it yourself. Take the time to institute these habits. You know, parents think that, oh, I should just tell my kid once and the kid should listen. No, these are habits that take a long time to develop, and parents don't have the stamina for that, and therefore call the kid bad when the kid doesn't pick up on it. It takes years for habits to institute themselves, good and bad.
When we come back, we're going to continue speaking with Shefali Sabari. As you heard her say, she's the author. She's a clinical psychologist, and her latest book is called The Awakened Family. We're taking the questions that you posted on Facebook. You can always find our Facebook page by searching for The 21st. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a minute.
First is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about parenting with author Shefali Sabari, a clinical psychologist, and her latest book is called The Awakened Family. We've been talking about how to reward, not to use a reward system for parents and children. And Shefali, I wanted to get back to that question from one of our listeners, Faith. And you say that reward systems for motivating good behavior can backfire. So as you're talking about sort of building an environment where you're bringing children along with you, what are ways to motivate kids without using a reward system?
Well, you know, the reason the reward system doesn't work is because then the kid holds you hostage to the rewards, you know, and then the only reason we're doing anything in life is for that reward or out of fear of punishment. So how do we create motivation? Well, it's, you know, akin to how you go to a company to work and your superiors at the work, you know, the people who are higher up than you at your workplace help create motivation. How do they do that? They find things that speak to you. They speak your language. They understand your limitations. They don't keep harping on them. They play on your strengths. They allow you autonomy and creativity. And then they make sure you buy into the values of the organization. Same with parenting. It takes work. You have to play to your kids' strengths. You have to help them see their beauty, their magnificence while they're doing it, so they buy into it. If it's only forced compliance, they will do it for us if they want to please us, or they will create rebellion, but eventually that will die out. It will be self-sabotaging at the end. So parents have to understand that anything they're asking from their kids that isn't coming from the kid themselves needs to be quote-unquote sold to them, right? They need to buy into it. They need to understand why we're doing it. And then the parent needs to embody that themselves. And I think that if we are prepared for pushback, if we're prepared for our children to question, to push back, as they should. They should be questioning beings. They shouldn't just take it passively. They should push back, but parents don't like that, you see, because we are not grounded in our own sense of inner empowerment. We don't like anyone to test us. But I believe kids should question, and then we should have a healthy dialogue and reach a compromise, and not a compromise where one feels like one has lost, but I call it in my book, The Awakened Family, a win-win situation for both people.
Shefali, I think there's so much pressure on parents to do things right, especially in this era of mommy wars and the internet and social media. And we got a comment on Facebook from Kate Carlson, and I wanted to ask you, and especially in light of everything that we saw with the really awful incident at the zoo in Cincinnati with the gorilla a couple weeks ago, and that whole national conversation that it spawned about parenting and expectations and the way that people judge parents. I wonder first, before we even get to the Facebook commenter and her issue, what your thoughts were as you watched all of this play out in the past 2 weeks?
You know, I see that the first place we go is, blaming somebody, right? We have to blame somebody. You know, and I don't subscribe to that. You know, I like to hold the best intentions for everyone, that we always are acting out of the best intentions. I don't think any parent would have imagined that their child would fall off and, you know, go into that pit with the gorilla. You know, this is not something a parent was thinking when they were being loving to take their kid to the zoo. Accidents happen. And I think parents need to learn to have compassion for each other. You know, of course, this doesn't mean we don't have compassion for animals. It was just one of those unfortunate situations, I think. But I am left with deep compassion for both, for the people who loved the gorilla and were taking care of the gorilla and animals in general, and compassion for the parent. This was one of those situations where it's just, you know,
it's just an awful situation.
It just is. And we have to learn to tolerate the isness of it without pitching somebody as evil and blaming somebody, or, you know, what must those parents have gone through, you know? I mean, and then to receive the onslaught of judgment from other parents, where other parents have done equally, you know, negligent things in their own home. I have done negligent things. You know, I was not looking once and my daughter fell off the bed, and I remember judging my mother for doing the same thing to me, and I said to her, how could you let me fall off the bed? Guess what? I did it. I looked the other way, boom, my daughter fell off the bed. And I was nauseous with guilt and shame and such debilitation for weeks, you know, and I was horrified that I did that. We are hard on ourselves. We don't need other parents to be hard on us. We need compassion and understanding. And sometimes situations are just all around tragic. And that's life, you know. We just need to accept that is life.
I'm speaking with Shefali Sabari. She's a clinical psychologist. She's speaking in Evanston this evening at 7 o'clock at Evanston Township High School about her new book. It's called The Awakened Family. We recorded this conversation with her earlier from New York because she was traveling. And so we asked you on Facebook for questions for her. And by the way, you can find our Facebook page by searching for The 21st. And to your point, what you were saying, Shefali, we got this comment from Kate Carlson, and she says that she was at church the other day and her daughter was tired and wired, and she kept feeling like I needed to control her daughter and keep her quiet. And she said, you know, her church was great. No one was even looking at her except with a loving smile, and she didn't feel any pressure from anyone else, but it was just inside of her the whole time. And as you know, as you're sharing your story about how racked with guilt you were, how do you think we can let go of that?
Exactly. We are prosecuting ourselves by these inner critics. Why? Because we were raised in cultures that are extremely judgmental, and we do it to each other. So you have to release yourself from being everyone else's judger and your own inner judger. You just have to say, okay, I'm done. Nobody's going to give you permission to stop judging yourself. You have to stop judging yourself today and not live like that anymore, because nobody's going to let you off the hook, you know? And everyone wants to judge, and everyone wants to pull someone down. And this is just the insecure nature of our beings that we do these things, and we need to stop. Of course we need to stop, but no one stops because we're all insecure from inside. We all want to look better than the other. We're so desperate inside. And so we have to learn to be whole. We have to learn to be compassionate. You know, so when you said about the gorilla and the child, I did not even respond to those comments because I'm not going to play that. I'm not playing one against the other. I'm just not doing that. And I never judged her in my own mind, and I never entered judgment. And if I had the time, you know, my book is out, so I was releasing my book. But if I did have time, I would have gone and declared that we need to have compassion and understanding and great acceptance for our mistakes. We never want to harm our children. No parent would do that. And we need to stop the blame game.
We got a Facebook comment from Jill Rackow, who it's reminding me of everything you're saying. This is what Jill said. We strive for respectful, gentle parenting in our home, which means accepting our children for who they are and the moments for what they are. We don't always succeed. We sometimes lose our tempers, but find that we get on our kids' level and try to see what they're experiencing. We all have more compassion, love, and respect for each other. Do you think that a lot of this just involves sometimes just taking a deep breath and stepping back?
Yes, and then asking the question. You know, what is this bringing up in me? What is this activating in me? If we hold that question up as the primary guiding point of our reactions, we no longer will spew out these negative reactions. Now we're going to be wise. We're going to be silent. We're going to understand this is all me. It's all me. It's all me. Let me take a look at it. Let me take a look at it. Let me calm this inner beast. Let me tame my desperate inner child. And automatically we will have a more benevolent response.
Jill Beatty shared this story with us on Facebook, and I wanted to share it with you. She said, I've been told by my almost three-year-old not to interfere with him and his friend when they fight. And initially she did try to intervene because she thought they were two-year-olds, and she was just thought that, well, we have to restrain them and I have to be an adult. And then that evening her son said, don't interfere, mommy. And she shares how it was not easy to honor this, but from since then she's done that. And of course she said she's around the corner listening to everything, peeking to make sure no one gets hurt. But then, yeah, the fight lasts like 30 seconds and they move on with their, quote, exuberant lives. Do you think parents should follow Jill's lead and maybe just kind of keep a watchful eye, but maybe not even intervene as much as possible?
Yes, and it's our fear that something bad is going to happen. And of course, we have to make sure that they're safe, right? We want to watch that they're in a safe environment, but not to micromanage their friendships, to let them figure it out. But yes, if they're that young at 3 and 5 and 7, I would say, yes, keep a watchful eye and a ear. You know, always have your ear out because they're very young and think negative things can happen very fast. And they're not able to control those things and dangerous things, but not to do so out of a desire to, because something is going to go bad emotionally. Let the kids figure it out emotionally. Just keep them physically safe. And then as they grow older, just kind of keep stepping back. And when your kid is a teenager, again, keep an eye, keep a watchful ear, and it all comes back to that connection you have with your child. So you always are keeping your finger on the pulse of their development to know, are they acting out of sorts? Are they, you know, denying something? Are they hiding something from me? You try as best as you can, and sometimes you're not successful, but you try the best as you can to keep that bond and that connection strong so that they will come to you. And but then you keep backing off because emotionally they have to figure this out on their own.
Shefali, I wonder how you think parents can do a better job nurturing those connections. Because I think especially, even when children are young, we all lead very busy lives. People are running from one place to another. You know, maybe you're having a meal in the car, or you're just kind of running all over and you're trying to work and juggle all of the other things that are involved with just living. So how do you suggest you can nurture sort of not just that mindfulness, but to take advantage of those moments? Are there simple strategies that you try to implement?
You know, lots of things. So first is to, you know, really be present to the child. So not constantly bombard them with your own agenda, your questions, your opinions. You know, that's what we do, which creates disconnection. You know, really be present. Stop being anxious around them. Stop over-managing them. Stop over-demanding them. Create time for that bonding and for that attunement, for them to come and lie with you, and creating the space for that deep bonding. You know, childhood is very short. And we don't have them for long. And let's not race them to adulthood. Let's enjoy them. Enjoy this relationship. They are the most beautiful beings we will ever meet in our lives. There will be no relationship like this. So spend the time every day to learn from them. You know, do it for you. This is like not selfless. It's selfish. I'm like, you learn, you bask, you enjoy, you touch. You are getting far more than you can ever give them if you can tap into that, the gifts that they give you.
Do you think that sometimes technology is a hindrance to this because kids see adults on devices, kids want their own devices? Do you think that technology plays a role in this lack of connection, or in, it makes it harder to nurture connections?
Yes, I think it's an easy distraction, right? Let's just go on our screens and then hours pass by and we've not looked up. I think screens are part of life. It just calls us to have more boundaries, to create the space to go play a game together. You know, you're forced as a parent to get off Facebook, which we all are addicted to ourselves, and then our kids are addicted to their own, you know, apps. So how do you as a parent say, okay, now enough, I need to go connect? And, you know, if we don't give it the highest priority, they're not going to do it.
Well, and what if you're listening to this, and I'm imagining maybe some parents who are listening to this who have maybe 10 or 12-year-olds or teenagers, and maybe they didn't do all of this nurturing or connection when they're younger. How do they intervene now to build that with their older kids?
Yeah, it's again, you know, if you've not done it for all these years, it's not going to be easy. You have to make a commitment. And
do you think it's possible?
It is always, everything is possible. Is it now going to be inordinately harder? Are your kids going to be more, you know, crusty and negative with you because they're not used to you coming around? They're going to be more defensive. They're going to be tough. Your kids are not going to open up as easily because you haven't created that path.
You write that letting go of control over our kids, our children, is probably the hardest spiritual task that we face as parents. We got another Facebook comment from Michelle who said that this was something her husband and her were just starting to realize. And this is what Michelle said. We don't control our children. We can't make them behave. Having been blessed with our first child who happens to be very strong-willed, we have learned that there's nothing we can say or do that will make her do anything. It's been a long time coming, but we're finally realizing there's another way to parent, and it starts with us learning to be better versions of ourselves. For parents who were really struggling with this, I wonder where you would suggest, we just have a couple more minutes before we end, what kind of final pieces of advice would you leave for them?
You know, yes, that parent is on the right path of understanding that it all starts with us. And this is all about us. So any journey that takes them inward, you know, journaling, mindfulness, meditation, reading spiritual health, self-help books, reading my books, my books offer a direct path to the inner self of the parent, especially the awakened family, and really taking this on as the central premise of their lives, to be a spiritual healer for themselves, would just enrich their every relationship, not just that with their child.
Thanks so much for being with us. Shefali Sabari is a clinical psychologist. She's author of, as she said, her latest book is called The Awakened Family. Again, she's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock in Evanston, at Evanston Township High School, and we'll be doing a Q&A and book signing. Shefali, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Just quickly, the program tonight is for free for people to come, and we're building community there, and lots of parents are coming. And they can go to my website, theawakenedfamily.com, to learn about the book and lots of bonuses that we're offering.
Thanks, Shefali.
Thank you.
We always love to hear your feedback. You can find us on Facebook, where people were posting questions for today's segment. Search for The 21st. You can message us there. You can also always email or call us. All of our contact information is on our website. That's www.21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. If you want to find past shows, you can find links to that as well there, to iTunes and Android. Or if you have the NPR One app, you can search for us for past shows. Search for The 21st. Coming up, we're going to be speaking with the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, Dr. Nirav Shah, about the first human case of West Nile virus that was confirmed in Illinois yesterday. He's going to be giving us some tips on how to deal with that this summer. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st.
21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Technology like GPS has changed the way we travel. Now it's also changing the way we spend time while stuck on a plane. Lots of you are planning vacation this summer. There's a new app we wanted to tell you about. It's called Flyover Country that follows your trip on a map and shows you what's out your window. Is that an old volcano or those historical sites? Was that a dinosaur dig? The app was created by a team at the University of Minnesota, including Amy Mirbeau. She joins us on the phone now from Minnesota. Hey, Amy, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
One description of the app says that it's a way for people to learn about the science behind their view out of their airplane or car window. How does this work? Especially if you're getting on a plane, I think people are wondering, do I have to pay for Wi-Fi access? Does this work if my phone's in airplane mode? What's the technology behind how this works?
Yeah, those are the number one and number two questions that we get. So what you do is on your phone, click on a few points that are on your flight path. So maybe the beginning and the end of your travel, or if you're taking a road trip, you can click on multiple points. And the app goes out and queries databases of geoscience information and Wikipedia and pulls down the points of interest that are within a buffer on either side of your flight or driving path. And it caches all this information offline to your phone. So it's saved. You just have to do that while you're still on Wi-Fi before you get on a plane or before you go out into the wilds of somewhere that doesn't have great data coverage. And so it's saved to your phone. You don't need to have a connection while you're then to look at the information afterward during your travel. And the GPS on your phone is just listening. It's passive, and so it's completely legal in airplane mode, and it works on phones. As long as you're pretty close to the airplane window, you should be able to pick up a great GPS signal.
Oh, interesting. So does it use the GPS on the plane then?
It does not. We may, in the future, become more integrated into planes, but right now it's just the GPS on your phone, and different phones have different qualities of GPS receivers.
Okay.
So sometimes you have to try a little bit hard, but you can almost always find yourself.
Well, I asked you about how it works before what you can see, because I think the first people want to know is this going to work? Because people seem probably skeptical about it. Now, can you tell us what you can see with the app? Because I was looking through, there's a lot of cool things, like you can see if there were dinosaur bones. What other kind of things can you find? There's a lot of science information that seems like it's compiled.
That's right. We're all, the team that developed it have all geology backgrounds. And so we're interested in, the geologists always want the window seat on the plane so that we can see landforms and volcanoes and say, oh, I hiked around there and studied it. Now I'm seeing it from the air. And so the kinds of information in there are right now all geoscience and sort of geographical information. There are a couple of different types of fossils, not just dinosaurs, but what geologists call the charismatic megafauna. So these are the critters that went extinct at the end of the last ice age, giant sloths and giant beavers and woolly mammoths and woolly rhinos and stuff. And in the app, if you click on a fossil dig and you find those fossils, you can also click through and read the Wikipedia articles about each of those and learn something about what scientists know about those extinct critters.
And that's where it pulls from? Does it pull mostly from Wikipedia then?
It pulls from Wikipedia, but also from a number of publicly available geoscience databases. And so one of the most important and cool things about this app is that it's completely funded by the National Science Foundation. And one of the ways that we're benefiting from many decades of NSF support of the geosciences is that we can query databases that have all the fossils ever reported, or what the bedrock is like all the way all around the world, things like that, and pull those very easily, relatively easily, as a non-technologist, and expose those in the app for anybody to see. And so the NSF support has really been critical.
Well, and also we should make note, this is also probably helped make the app free too as well, right?
Exactly. Yep.
Where did you get
and
this?
So it is available both for Android and iOS.
Yeah. Also. Amy, I was wondering where you got this idea from. And we were talking about this, all the producers, we were talking about this morning, and I was thinking, you used to hear pilots on planes all the time kind of be a little bit of a tour guide and especially say like, oh,
yeah,
you know, you're flying over the Grand Canyon. And I feel like that doesn't happen as much anymore. So I wonder where you guys got the idea to do this from.
Yeah, well, this was the idea, the genius idea of my colleague and student Shane Loeffler, who originated the idea. And he was flying and looking down and realized that his GPS worked and was looking at some maps that you can that you've been able to look at offline, some things that are cached to your phone, and realizing that he could tell where he was, but there was no way that he could find information easily offline about, say, the mountains he was flying over or the crater that he could see below him. And he sort of put this all together and thought, well, this is an app that should exist. And, you know, he told me about it. I thought it was great. And the rest is sort of history, except for, you know, the huge struggle of development.
but you've got it to launch. It's been out for a couple of months. Do you know how many people are using it? What kind of feedback are you getting?
We're getting great feedback. We've had 120 news stories, unique news stories. I guess this makes 121 in 27 different countries. We have about 110,000 downloads now between iOS and Android.
And when you say in other countries, does this work in other countries as well?
It is worldwide. Yep. So works everywhere. And we recently added the geologic maps around the world. These come from a resource that we use called MacroStrat, which is out of the University of Wisconsin in Madison, which is also NSF funded, which has put together these geologic maps from extremely disparate sources all over the world and given them to us and you know, they're available on the MacroStrat website as well, to be able to look at and learn about what the characteristics are of these of the rocks below us.
And Amy, just to be clear, it's called Flyover Country, but you can actually, obviously, you can use this in a car too, right? Obviously, we don't want people
Absolutely.
Who are driving to be using this, but if you're not the person behind the wheel, this is a great app.
Yep, exactly. And we're on hiking trips, and there's a little function in the app that you can choose between a flight path, a flying trip, and a car or hike trip. And the difference is that you get higher resolution geologic maps. So there's a little more information, a little more detail. That detail would kind of blow up the size of your flight path if you needed it over, you know, a huge buffer for 1,000 miles. But with a narrower buffer on a hiking or driving path, we can give you more information.
Amy, is this something that's available for kids as well as adults? I mean, what age range would you recommend are able to look at this map? I mean,
you know, I think it's anybody, you know, anybody who's interested. I know that, you know, a lot of the content, you know, Wikipedia stuff content is pretty accessible. Some of the other descriptions are a little bit on the scientific side, and we're actively working on how we could potentially do some leveling of the text of, you know, to make things more accessible, more integrated, so that people without a scientific background and especially kids could use it. But we've certainly heard reports of, you know, kids using it in the classroom to learn about, say, the geology around their hometown or a place where, you know, a place where their parents are from.
Amy, the app's called Flyover Country. That's often not seen as a positive thing, that term. So I wonder if the name choice was a deliberate one to try to reclaim this term in a more positive light.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we're, you know, it seemed descriptive in a cute way, but it's also, you know, I'm from Minnesota. My colleagues on the app are, you know, some of them are from here. We all live here and we think it's great. And we think there's a ton to recommend, you know, the middle of the country to people. And so, yeah, it's a little bit of reclaiming of making a joke about that. But it does kind of hide the fact that you can use it on the ground as well, and that you can use it worldwide. But we want to emphasize that both of those things are true.
That's Amy Mirbeau. She's the co-creator with Shane Loeffler, as you heard her say, of Flyover Country. It's a mobile app that's available for free on iTunes and Android, a great thing for your summer travel. She's a researcher. Her day job is in earth sciences at the University of Minnesota, and she joined us from Minnesota. Hey, Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for calling. Have fun using the app.
We will.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
The first human case of West Nile virus in Illinois was confirmed by the State Department of Public Health yesterday. It's a few months earlier than public health officials expected. And joining us now to talk about that case and precautions we should be taking for the summer, not just for West Nile, but also for other mosquito-borne illnesses everyone's concerned about, including the Zika virus, is the director of the Department of Public Health for Illinois, Dr. Nirav Shah. Dr. Shah, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla. It's great to be back.
When do we typically see cases of West Nile virus? How early is this compared to last summer?
Typically in Illinois, we see cases of West Nile that emerge or are diagnosed in mid-August or so. So here with the first case in early June, we're several weeks ahead of schedule. Although cases of West Nile this early in the season are rare, they have occurred from time to time. There are a lot of hypotheses as to why that might exist. One hypothesis is that we had an unusually mild winter, which might not have resulted in the hard frost and freezing that often obliterates the mosquito population over the course of that winter, thus allowing them to start up and be active a little earlier in the summer. But the truth of the matter is we are not quite sure why this case has arisen so early.
Where was this case?
For reasons of privacy, we don't actually disclose the location of any of these individuals.
And do you disclose where you found mosquitoes and where you found birds with West Nile virus? Correct.
That's correct. Every year, one of the disease surveillance activities that our agency undertakes is to look for birds and mosquitoes that carry West Nile virus. You may wonder why we do both. Well, West Nile is an interesting virus. A lot of viral borne diseases get transmitted from humans to mosquitoes, back to humans, and back to mosquitoes. West Nile actually involves birds as well. So birds are one of the carriers of West Nile virus. Mosquitoes acquire the virus themselves from feeding on birds and then can transmit it to humans. So we cast a wide net all across the state to look for areas of the state that have birds with West Nile as well as mosquitoes with West Nile.
4 out of 5 people who are infected with West Nile virus don't show symptoms, but we also know that you all reported 9 deaths from West Nile virus in Illinois last year. Can you just remind us what the symptoms of West Nile virus are for people?
Certainly. The symptoms of West Nile virus are somewhat similar to a really bad flu. Fevers, headaches, body aches, joint pain. In some cases, folks will have diarrhea. And these are the symptoms that if you do experience in any fashion, it's important to call your healthcare provider. There are a lot of things that can cause those symptoms, but your healthcare provider, your local physician, can think about all of those things and certainly arrange for you to be tested, not just for West Nile, but for many of the other signs and symptoms that could lead to the diseases of that sort.
Dr. Shah, I think people can't help but think about the Zika virus, and they might be more concerned for that with all the media coverage we've seen. And I just wonder who you think should be worried about the Zika virus this summer.
Well, I'm really glad you brought up Zika virus. One of the most important things to keep in mind is that the risk of Zika virus appearing in Illinois is very low. The mosquito that is responsible for transmitting Zika virus is not one that has been found in Illinois. By contrast, the mosquito that transmits West Nile virus is most definitely one that is found in Illinois. To put it differently and to put it starkly, Nyla, West Nile virus is a risk to residents of Illinois. Zika virus, in the scheme of things, is a much, much lower risk. That's not to say Zika virus is a zero risk. if you are planning to travel to parts of the world where Zika virus transmission is ongoing, this is Central America, South America, you should absolutely take precautionary steps. If your summer travel plans include going to those countries, you should cover up. You should wear insect repellent. You should try to stay in a hotel with screens and air conditioning. But if you're planning to just be in Illinois over the summer, West Nile is the thing to be worried about. But you should still take those same precautions.
That's Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Dr. Shah, it's always great to have you on the 21st. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Thank you so much, Nyla.
And that's all the time we have for today's program. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the issue of school funding. Some schools are saying no state funds means maybe not opening this fall. We'll be talking to three school district superintendents from across the state to hear firsthand how the lack of money is affecting students, teachers, and programs. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to the 21st.